This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. In the early 80s, Fleet Mall was living a split life. He would spend part of the year doing drugs and smuggling cocaine up from Latin America. And the other part of the year, he was actively carrying out his practice as a Buddhist. Then in 1985, it all blew apart. He was convicted of drug smuggling and was hit with a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence. At that time, he couldn't imagine how he was going to survive all those years in prison. But Mall has turned his prison experience into a time of spiritual growth. He started group meditation sessions for the prisoners and expanded that into the National Prison Dharma Network. And he, along with some other prisoners, started a hospice program for dying inmates. Mall is one of the healthy inmates incarcerated at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. I spoke with him on the phone yesterday and asked him how he was able to meditate in a prison environment.
I turned myself in May of 1985, and I was incarcerated in a county jail for 7 months during my trial and sentencing, and before I was sent here to the federal prison in Springfield. And the county jail was a really horrific environment, very, very hot, very crowded, extremely noisy and chaotic. It was a very insane environment. But I knew I had to practice. At that point in my life, I mean, I knew things were really on the line at that point. In terms of my life, and I knew I had to practice, and so I just started doing it. I think there was one particular experience where I was sitting on the upper bunk in this little two-man cell, and it was all kinds of noise and chaos going, three or four TVs going, and people yelling and talking, and I had been sitting there trying to follow my breath for about 2 hours, and suddenly I noticed that my mind wasn't moving. That all this noise and chaos was not drawing my attention away. I was completely aware of it all, but it was not causing me to be distracted. And even though there were a few thoughts arising here or there, they were not causing me to be distracted either. My mind was just completely clear and unmoving and stable. And that was kind of a profound experience. I had had similar experiences like that in meditation retreats, but to experience that in the midst of all this chaos was quite assuring in a way, and that sort of became the cornerstone of my practice ever since.
Well, I'm curious because in thinking about practicing Buddhism inside of a prison, I'm curious about whether there's something about prison life that is conducive to a contemplative life, and I'm thinking about the fact that you do have some time on your hands. There is a kind of routine, a sameness that's part of the structure. There are few worldly distractions. Have you found that to be true?
You're right, and for that reason, people often compare the idea of being in prison to the idea of being in a monastery, but it only goes so far.
Right.
All those things you said are true, but on the other hand, it's very, very difficult to find a quiet place to do any kind of contemplative practice. And also, if you want to compare it to a practice environment that is set up for practice, where there are few distractions and few worldly responsibilities and a sort of a general routine, those places are designed to encourage mindfulness, paying attention to one's experience. And everyone else in that environment is trying to do that. Here, everyone else is trying to remain as distracted as they possibly can so that they can try not to realize they're here as much of the day as they can. People are generally trying to kill time, and the environment is very noisy and so forth, and there's a tremendous atmosphere of anger and bitterness that's just under the surface with everyone. It's not to say that everybody walks around with a sour expression on their face. People joke and laugh, and there's a lot of black humor, prison humor sort of thing, but at the same time, if you just sort of scratch the surface and ask somebody a few questions, you normally get quite a bit of anger or sadness or grief, and so it's that kind of an atmosphere. But if you have some foundation in awareness training of some kind, then that becomes actually a very rich place to practice, because there's this very intense environment that is kind of in your face all the time. And you're always going to be having some reaction to it. And so if you've trained yourself to be present to your state of mind and to be curious about it, then you're going to immediately notice all the time where your state of mind is at. You're either going to be reacting with tremendous irritation and anger, or if you're in a very clear, open state of mind, you'll react with a sense of humor sometimes, or a sense of curiosity to what is really an environment that would drive most people crazy.
How did you become interested in hospice work?
When I arrived here in December of 1985, this being a medical institution, I was immediately struck by the amount of suffering. Even if you've never been up to one of the hospital wards, out in the yard you see people in wheelchairs. In the halls you see people in wheelchairs. You see people using canes and walkers and crutches. And you see people who are obviously emaciated from cancer and other illnesses. And even though I was obviously very overwhelmed by the experience of having been sentenced to 25 years in prison, I was still immediately struck by that. And it was very helpful in a way for me, because I realized that obviously there were a lot of people that had it much worse than I did. And it just really moved me, and I wanted to find some way to be helpful. The other thing was that this was just about the time when the AIDS crisis or epidemic in this country was beginning to come to the light. And so there was a lot of lot going on in the prison system about that. Among the prison population, the prisoners themselves were very upset and scared. And the prison administrations were trying to figure out how to deal with their HIV-positive inmates and with their AIDS patients. And I think in the first year I was here, originally they were, one point anyway, isolating AIDS patients in a special lockdown unit. And they were doing this really more to protect the patients than for any other reason, because there was fear of reprisals from the rest of the inmate population, because the inmate population was just very scared at that point, not thinking very clearly. They hadn't been educated about it. So I was really struck by their plight. I happened to be involved with a service organization at that time and was taking movies around, showing them on hospital wards. And I used to take the projector and the movies over to this AIDS ward and so forth. So I just kind of became concerned about that and started writing to organizations on the outside to try and see what I could find out about maybe being of help in here.
Well, in 91, you founded the National Prison Hospice Association. How did you go about creating or trying to create a humane environment for the dying and the sick inside of a prison?
Mm-hmm. Well, the program here actually began with the inspiration of another prisoner who himself was a patient, a paraplegic patient, and he was living on a hospital ward, and he just happened to sort of get to know several patients who were dying. I think one was dying of cancer and another of AIDS, and he befriended them and got very close to them and stayed with them through their deaths. And he saw what a tremendous need there was for this. These men were basically dying alone up on these hospital wards, and he felt that this was something other people could do. And so he started talking to prison administration about that, and I heard about it and offered to get involved. And eventually this program started in, we started training in 1987, but the program actually kicked off in 1988, in January of 88, and we started seeing patients. And basically what we try to do is be a friend to begin with. In many cases you become like a surrogate family person, just to be there for the patient so he knows that there's someone who cares. We can't change the physical layout of the prison hospital. We can't immediately change the typical attitudes that exist in a prison setting, but we could be there for the person. We could be a friend to them, and we could they could know that there was somebody that cared about them. And that's really what it was to begin with. It's evolved into more than that now, but to begin with, it was just to be there.
Let me ask you, though, do you think a dying inmate wants anything different from someone else on their deathbed?
Well, what a dying inmate wants is not to be dying in prison. They want out. Universally, they are very, two things. Dying in prison is like some sense of, like an ultimate mark of failure on your life. And I think they almost always see it that way. And so their greatest hope all along is to either somehow survive their illness until they could finish their prison sentence, unless they're looking at a lot of time, or possibly to receive a compassionate early release, which happens in a few cases. And so their biggest thing they want is either to be cured or to be let to go home to die. They don't want to die in prison.
Fleet Mall is an inmate at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Missouri. We'll hear more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fleet Mall. He's an inmate at the federal prison in Springfield, Missouri. Do you find that people want to confess things to you? They want to share perhaps secrets of their life?
That's true in some cases. I think the first thing is that they don't want to be alone, and many of them don't want to die alone. And they do have the need to share. Not in all cases. A lot of prisoners have a very strong, developed sense of you don't talk about your business with anyone, and you don't get involved in anybody else's business. That's a very strong ethic of sorts, in prison.
Is that so? You won't be vulnerable?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the longer they've been in prison, the more strongly they may have that. On the other hand, there are some who are not particularly affected by that particular idea, and they just really want someone to talk to, and they immediately start sharing all about their life with you. There are others who you'll spend months with, and you'll find very little bit about them. In terms of actually sort of the idea of confessing or wanting to get some things off their chest that they have never told anyone, that happens. I don't think it happens a lot or that it's necessarily the regular thing, but it happens, and certainly we're trained to be ready for that and to try and skillfully be there for them in a way that they feel comfortable doing that if they want to do that and need to do that.
Is it hard to sit with someone and not talk? I know for myself, with friends that have been ill and some even near death, you feel the need to fill up the time with conversation, but sometimes that's not what they want.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that we emphasize in our training of the hospice volunteers here. And it is a difficult thing to learn. But once you do get a feel for that, I think you can, and if you're able to do it with a patient and just be there for them when they've made it clear that they don't really want to talk, they might even turn towards the wall in some cases. And you kind of wonder, well, maybe they want you to leave. And in some cases, you might actually ask that. But if you've gotten to know them better, you may realize, no, I'm not going to ask that because I'm not picking up that signal. I would know if you wanted me to leave. So you just stay and sit with them. And you may sit with them for even a half hour or longer. And you find that you can settle into a very sort of comfortable, peaceful place with them. Because maybe this is the one time when they're able to relax. Some of the patients actually, towards the end of their illness, are so afraid of dying or so afraid of dying alone that they can't sleep. They're terrified of going to sleep. They're afraid they'll die in their sleep. And so if you're able to sit with them, sometimes they'll use that time just to sleep. They can actually relax because they know that their friend is sitting there with them.
Have you then been with someone at their death and held their hand or been with them as they have died?
Yes, a number of times. Very profound, humbling experience.
Can you actually see life leave them?
That's a very good question, and it's something I've thought quite deeply about. There's been a few instances where I felt sort of something about that transition, of witnessing that transition. But more often, to tell you the truth, even though you're right there and you're watching, it's just like one moment they're there and the next minute they're not, or the next second they're not. They take that last breath and suddenly there's no one there. And the finality of that is very, very powerful. And the fact that even though maybe here's this person who's all skin and bones, laying in front of you, just literally all skin and bones. But obviously there's life there. And in fact, sometimes a very powerful experience for me has been that it seems sometimes as the body diminishes and wastes away, it seems you become more aware of the being of that person, which seems somehow larger than what's left of the body. So there's this very much this life there, this being there, and then suddenly just gone.
So has hospice work made you think about your own life and death?
Well, yes, honestly, quite a bit. It puts you very much in touch with your own mortality. Being here in prison and working with men your own age who are dying of cancer or AIDS, you realize it could happen to you at any time, and that's pretty scary. The idea of you could suddenly have a pain somewhere or feel sick and go to the doctor and they run a test and you've got cancer and you realize maybe you're not going to get out of prison either. You know, that's pretty scary. Also, I had one patient. He was an AIDS patient. We'd actually become friends before he was assigned to me as my patient. He had come to the Buddhist meditation group that I sort of coordinate here in. And he had actually recovered from a bout of pneumocystis and was quite healthy when he came to the group. And he got very involved in the group over a period of 3 or 4 months, and we became friends. And then, because he was well, he was transferred back out to a regular institution. But later, he became quite ill again, and eventually was brought back here. And I found out he was here. Actually, he asked for me, and I was able to be assigned as his hospice volunteer. And I was with him for the next 6 months through tremendous, tremendous suffering that he went through, just horrible. And but at any rate, we had so much similarity in our backgrounds. We'd both been involved in some drug smuggling and drug addiction. He had a son the same age as I did. We just had a lot of similarities in our background. I could identify with him very clearly. And it was very hard for me to remain objective as I was working with him. When he would be talking about, a lot of what he was dealing with was the shame and the grief and the sadness over what he'd done to his son, basically, and his daughter, his two children, just sort of leaving them, and the legacy he was leaving for them. And as he'd be saying these things to me, it was pretty hard for me to stay focused and be there for him because I was getting flooded with all his own imagery about my own life and my own son. So, yes, this work is very powerful in that way. It puts you in touch with a lot of things, and that's why I feel very fortunate that I have a contemplative practice and with which to deal with a lot of those things.
You talk about your Buddhism helping you cope with certainly the emotions of being in prison and coping with your, I guess, the intellectual challenge of being in prison as well. But does it always work?
Yes, it does, actually.
Really?
Very, very profoundly. And not in terms of managing that or getting away from it. Actually, interestingly enough, I've been kind of watching this over the last couple of years, and people sometimes ask me related questions of whether, you know, it's getting easier to be here. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's getting harder. Mm-hmm. The experience of being away from my family, especially away from my son, I have an 18-year-old son who's grown up the last 9 years without me, and the experience of all that is becoming even more acute. It comes up at times in this flash of the reality of here I am, and this is my life, and this is what I've done to people, and this is, and I still have what still feels to me like a lot of time to do. It comes up very acutely. But at the same time, because I have the kind of training to stay with that when it comes up, not even as a conscious decision of, oh, I need to stay with this because that'll be good for me, but it's just a natural thing, there seems to be this quality of, here's all this acute pain, and but there's some space around that, and it begins to sort of dissolve into that space of some kind of awareness. And out of that, there's this kind of unconditional joy that it gets met with. This combination of, well, there's this the pain, and there's a letting go, and then there's this kind of unconditional joy, which is inexplicable and is something very, very sort of unconditional quality of just being that comes up. And I think that's come out of my retreat practice a lot. I've been fortunate enough to be able to do a 10-day intensive retreat here in my room each year for the last 4 years. And I think especially in the last couple of years that's been happening. So, yes, even at the worst moments of being in prison, emotionally, at the times of the worst emotional pain and crisis, my Buddhist training and awareness training kicks in its most powerful way, really.
Well, certainly looking back at what you've been able to accomplish in prison, it it almost feels, at least to us listening to you, as if you were given a gift in a way, a chance to really change your life and a chance to develop yourself as a spiritual person. Do you see your imprisonment quite like that?
Yes. Sometimes it's difficult to see it like that, but I do. I actually do. And but there's sometimes when I'm, you know, that feeling comes up that I see it so clearly that way, and I kind of well, come on, you know, prison is terrible. You know, I kind of look at it that way. But looking at it objectively, it has been a tremendous gift in my life. It stopped all the craziness. You know, I had this kind of split life going on before I came to prison. There was a lot of good things going on in my life, and some very genuine contact with a spiritual discipline. I had gone back and got a master's degree, and at the same time, I was leading this totally crazy life and doing harm to others and being involved in drugs and drug trafficking, very, very harmful things, which I regret very deeply, doing harm to my family. It was just, even in terms of my lifestyle, it's been part of the year of meditation retreats and part of the year running around in this crazy smuggler's lifestyle, so it was all crazy. When I came to prison, all the craziness had to stop. It just stopped dead. And so the rest of it was able to grow and to flower. And it's really been a tremendous gift. And the opportunities I've had in here to get involved in trying to help some people. I think for me, in terms of rehabilitation, the most powerful vehicle, I think, is some combination of a contemplative practice and service, helping others. And I think if we can find ways for prisoners, especially people who have been through a lot of trauma or drug addiction or early family trauma or whatever, just a trauma being in prison, I think that's the most powerful thing they can do.
Fleet Maul, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're very welcome, Marty.
Fleet Maul was sentenced to 25 years in prison for drug smuggling back in 1985. He's an inmate at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.